Welcome to the Mormon Marriages Podcast. I am Angeline Bagley.
And I am Nate Bagley.
As members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we believe that the most important thing in life is your family. And the backbone of your family is your marriage.
So on this podcast, we talk with couples from the church who provide amazing insights into what it takes to create a marriage that will make you look forward to eternity.
It would mean a lot to us if you subscribe to the show, review it on iTunes, and reach out to us if you have any questions, suggestions, or ideas to make it even better.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome to another episode. Today, we are with Kristen Hodson again. So we've had her on our podcast. I think this is now the third time we've had her on the podcast.
Yeah.
The first time it was with her and her husband, Jake, and they talked about moving to Costa Rica. The second time we talked about betrayal trauma with her. And today is more of a, I can't quite tell if it's a prequel or a sequel to that episode, but essentially we're just continuing the conversation about betrayal trauma, and it's a really important topic.
It's a great conversation.
Kristen is a licensed clinical social worker and a sex certified sex therapist. And next weekend, she's having her Rocky Mountain Sex Summit.
Which we will be at.
We will be there. We've gone every year to it. And she does a fantastic job. And it's mostly, in the past, it's been a lot of therapists that have gone. And we've kind of been like the non-therapists there. But this weekend, it's talking about
women's reproductive health,
and it's going to be really, really great, and it's for anyone. So we'll link to her website and how you can get tickets. I think there's still tickets available.
Yeah, come join us.
But it'll be really fun. It's next weekend, November 15th to the 16th, if you're listening to this after the fact. But we hope you come say hi and learn about how women's reproductive health is so important.
And if you missed the conference that she's putting on, or you're just not in Utah, which is a lot of you, you can follow her at Kristen B. Hodson on Instagram.
She has a fabulous Instagram.
It's so good. She talks about really amazing things.
She talks about being the sex expert of your own life, and she talks a lot about how to navigate talking to kids about sex.
Yeah.
And just women's health in general. Great follow.
Before we dive into the episode, can I just say one more thing to our lovely listeners?
Go for it.
So we just moved the podcast over to a new hosting platform so we could have a little bit more insight into who's listening and how many people are downloading the episodes. And I don't know if we've shared this with them, but like almost in the last 30 days, we've had close to 100,000 downloads.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
It's so great.
So I just wanted to say thank you. If you've been listening from the beginning, or if you came in late and have gone back and listened to all the episodes, if you've shared this with a friend, if you've left a rating or a review on iTunes, thank you. It is amazing the outpouring of love and support that we've had since we launched this podcast. It's a fun little hobby. We're going to try and get a little bit more consistent with our episodes over the next couple of months, and we're going to work on improving the audio
the
levels
quality,
and everything.
Yes.
So all that stuff will come, but more than anything, I just wanted to let you know that we're working hard doing this for free, trying to provide you guys with a great resource, and your support and being willing to listen to these episodes just means a whole lot to us. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Enjoy. Welcome, everybody.
Hi.
We have a really fantastic episode today.
We do.
I would like to paint a picture for you. At this moment, I want you to imagine you are a little girl, you're in primary, and you're singing, "I love to see the temple, I'll go inside someday." And from that young age, you imagine the life that you're going to have when you're older. You imagine going inside the temple with the man of your dreams, and in Young Women's, you outlined exactly what that man would be like. You wrote down all of his qualities. He was going to be a returned missionary, and he was going to be an honorable priesthood holder, and he was going to help you create a life that would qualify you for celestial glory. And you had this idea in your head of this marriage that carried you through all these years, and eventually you find the man, he's the one, you go to the temple, you get married, everything is going the way you imagined it, and one day you open up your browser and you see the history and realize that this isn't what you thought it was going to be. You start feeling shocked. You're in disbelief. You're humiliated. You are disoriented. You're jealous. You have this rage. And all of a sudden, the story that you told yourself as a little girl is no longer your story. You've been robbed of that story, and you feel betrayed. What do you do now?
Way to set the stage. Go ahead.
This is powerful. Like, I don't want to jump in, but I'm like, who doesn't resonate with that story? Mm-hmm. Who doesn't connect with that little girl that has that story, and you work so hard to have that story, and you work and put effort in so that you're deserving of that story? Mm-hmm.
I remember as a 16-year-old girl in Young Women's, we were encouraged to write a letter to our future husbands, and I did that. And I wrote every single quality that he was going to have. I pictured it out. Dear future husband, today is our wedding day, and I'm so excited to share eternity with you. You are a man who is worthy of the priesthood, who is, you know, all these qualities that honestly was just putting every single man out there in a box.
real talk.
Go ahead.
You told me this before. Mm-hmm. You thought you were going to marry General Authority.
I don't know if General Authority is the right word, but I pictured myself like being the mission president's wife and having my husband be in all these leadership positions and just
basking in his
celestial glory.
Little did you know, you would marry a guy with a beard.
But that is the...
would never get a leadership calling because he has a beard.
And I love your beard.
I know.
But
I'm just teasing.
But that's the story that I pictured for myself, and the story that I thought was what it was supposed to be, that what it was supposed to look like.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of women who've grown up in the church can relate to that same story. Especially, we wanted to start with that story because I would say 40% of the questions that we get from our audience revolve around some form of betrayal. Mm-hmm. Some form of a, this isn't the story that I pictured for myself. I'm being robbed of this life that I imagined for myself, and how dare my husband rob that from me. Now what do? I'm angry.
I was told if I lived worthily and kept the commandments and did all these things and checked all the boxes and married a man in the right place at the right time, that I would have a life like this. And now I don't.
Well, and you're never, we never talk about how life could look differently. And so when all of a sudden you're stripped of that, you're lost because you haven't even let yourself imagine anything different. And it's a scary feeling to have. And it's also really sad for the husbands who are on the other side of it as well, mm-hmm. who are being compared to an imaginary man that doesn't exist.
That's really interesting that you say that. Because a lot of what women are complaining of is being compared to an imaginary woman.
Right.
When what the whole standard they're holding their husband to might be an imaginary man.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Kristen, this is what you study. This is your jam. Mm-hmm. This is your expertise. Mm-hmm. And this is why we wanted to bring you on, because we have so many people reaching out to us who are in crisis, and their identity as a married person, as a member of the church, as a child of God, as a daughter of God, is kind of like up in the air, and they're just grasping for some semblance of hope and some sort of foundation on which they can ground themselves. They want advice. They want help when they're in this moment of what feels like betrayal.
Absolutely. And it is a betrayal, right? Like, mm-hmm. it is a betrayal. I would say it's deeper than a feeling, because oftentimes people go into a marriage, when I hear Angeline's story, you go in with an undiscussed, assumed, shared set of values and agreements. Mm-hmm. It's when I talk to couples, it's like, well, what is there to talk about? Because we both are Mormon, because we both have temple recommends, there's actually no discussion that needs to be had. These are the agreements that we are both agreeing to. And then the conversations actually begin once they're broken. Mm. And that's when those meaningful conversations happen, but they're in the wake of betrayal. Mm. They're in a stage when people feel really disoriented, really scared. Mm-hmm. Sometimes this happens when you have a child on board and you're like, now I'm really stuck. And going back to that little girl, how many times did all of us say, if he does this, I will never. I'm out. Mm-hmm. And then what oftentimes happens is that little girl who now discovers her husband's browser history turns to Facebook and finds a group that now names what your husband is doing. And you actually are like, this is worse than I thought. Mm-hmm. And now you're worried and you go back to your Relief Society lesson. You're like, am I married to Ted Bundy? And it gets mm-hmm. worse mm-hmm. and it gets worse and you feel stuck. And then you feel even more isolated. Because where you might have turned to your family or your best friend, you don't want to because this is your husband and you're not sure. So now the secret that was once held by your partner is now being held by you, and you're holding the secret, and you now are more isolated than you ever imagined, and you don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty terrible and lonely.
It absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And I want to validate the reason why I say that it's not intended to be dramatic. This is often the process that people follow. And when people come to my office or they go to your podcast and they're asking you a question, oftentimes people already have a diagnosis. They already have named what this is.
They've self-diagnosed.
That's right.
When you say they have a diagnosis, it's not from a mental health professional.
No.
It's from a Facebook group or from a friend.
A Google search.
Yes. And what this behavior means is this.
Why are people so eager to find a diagnosis or to get a diagnosis?
I think they want to try to understand what's going on. They want to understand what it is. That everyone wants to have a name for what they're feeling.
Right.
And once you can name it, then you can solve it, and then you can get back to a place of comfort and knowing. But when you all of a sudden have, I think of it like this, when you're describing, you find the browser history. If you're outside and you see a spider, you anticipate the spider, mm-hmm. and your reaction is going to be very different than if you're sitting and watching TV or you're sitting in the baby nursery rocking your baby and you see a giant spider walk down the wall. It's a very different experience. And so when you kind of talked about these different scenarios, when you have this one idea in which your marriage is going to unfold before you, and suddenly you find this browser history, that is like seeing the spider coming down the wall and you're not expecting it. You have all of these reactions. Mm-hmm. So I think in that moment, people are eager to just like get the spider out of the bedroom.
Smush it.
Gotcha. To get smush it out of there. It is to squelch this, to regain control, to regain comfort, and to move on and get back to what you had.
Everything can be back to what it used to be.
And it's really at that moment, I want to name it because it's crisis. It is an absolute crisis. And I really see most people turn to Google mm-hmm. in that moment of crisis. Mm-hmm. And they're not wrong. However, I can tell you that Google, like if you have a burn on your arm, you're going to go to Google and you're going to actually see worst case scenario that maybe your arm's going to be amputated.
Right.
And that didn't even cross your mind. You're like, right. I had a burn, but I didn't realize how bad this is. That's oftentimes what happens in these instances mm-hmm. or these Facebook groups. And you see women that have already, your husband's already doomed. Your marriage is already
right.
over.
Right.
Right.
Before it's even had a chance to figure
before
out
before you even
means.
Talk to your husband about it.
Right. Exactly.
Right. I also wanted to mention we talked with you about betrayal trauma before, and we have a wonderful episode on that where we talk about the vision beyond repair. I think it's important to say this is like a prequel to that. Mm-hmm. When you get to that point where you can talk about the vision beyond repair, you've had some healing already, mm-hmm. but in this initial feeling, like you said, in crisis, there's something that needs to be done about the crisis before we can even think about
exactly
vision beyond repair.
And what I've seen with a lot of the requests that have come in over the last couple of the year or so that we've had this podcast is we get people asking for advice saying that they've been living in crisis for years. Mm-hmm. Like, my husband looked at porn 10 years ago. And I still can't trust him, and I don't know if he's going to relapse, or he went back and he's a porn addict and he didn't look for 6 years and then he went back and looked again more recently, and now I don't know what to do. It feels like our world is crashing down around us. And it's like there's this moment of crisis, and then there's a lifetime of wondering, can I trust again? Can I love again? Can I freely give of myself again? Can I trust? Can I know that he's not going to look again? And what does this mean? Like, there's a whole narrative wrapped up around that of a complete, it's like once it happens, the crisis never ends. They're constantly walking around in fear that it could happen again, or when will it happen again? And if it does happen again, what are they going to do about it? And what does that say about, and they can't have a trusting relationship. They can't have a loving relationship.
Well, I think what oftentimes happens, particularly in our culture, is you discover a browser history, you see a text on a phone, you see something, and then because we're in crisis and we want to name it, we want to solve it, we actually move right into treatment. Like, meaning we find a program, we find a therapist, we get in there, let's just stop this behavior, and it moves to a behavioral-based management thing. When really, you guys talked about such an emotional world crashing, and it was a betrayal. And I think what happens is we skip over a lot of stuff in the name of trying to solve the problem.
Right.
But I don't think we solved the root problem that after crisis phase, and we'll get to this, but there's a lot of times when, for most women, in that moment when they discover it, the questions they really wonder is, well, what does this mean for us? How does he feel about me? Is that the body he wants? Is my body good enough? Is our sex good enough? Does he still love me? Do I still love him? There's so many questions that are not named. And that is often why people stay in a state of crisis, because they don't go to that place. And so then they just spend their time managing and kind of putting on an internal surveillance camera. Mm-hmm. That their security is dependent on their husband behaving correctly. That you don't ever feel secure in that.
You don't have control over that.
You have no control. Mm-hmm. And then if you put that into the addiction model, you're always anticipating relapse. So you're never really on a sure foundation trying to answer those deep, deep, deep questions of the value of your relationship. Who am I in my partner's eyes? What does this mean? We skip over a lot of that. So in the name of trying to get secure or find security, we actually breed further insecurity.
So we try and quiet our own fears and insecurities by trying to control our partner's behavior.
Mm-hmm. And I think we find comfort in them being an addict. I've said this a lot. I empathize in a woman's hope, desire, need for their husband to be an addict, because then they don't have to, ask those questions that can be really terrifying. Like, I may not want to ask that question because I don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe this does mean, like, our imaginations can run wild in the crisis phase. Like I said, I bring up Ted Bundy because I've sat in many Relief Society lessons where people move to this corollary place.
Well, Ted Bundy said he was all inspired by pornography, so right. My husband's going to be a serial killer one day.
Right.
Which is always fascinating,
right.
Because the piece of the story that's, well, there's a lot of Ted Bundy's story that's actually cut out, but this one piece that fits the narrative of the person using porn, the whole neighborhood had porn magazines.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he found some of his porn magazines looking in his neighbor's garbage
cans. So he had a whole neighborhood of serial killers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so But that's a really scary feeling.
Right.
It's a really, but so in crisis, you're managing crisis. You are not making meaning. You are not having deep connecting relationships. You are feeling, you use the word disorienting, you have lost your compass. Well, you have lost your formula, your plan. It's all gone.
In that sense, in that state of mind, it's almost impossible to think rationally.
It is
impossible. Because you're in fight or flight mode. You're either like, I got to fight this, or I got to get out of here, or you freeze. It's just...
And you're not even cognitive, like you're not consciously thinking that.
Right.
Your brain is doing what it does is, this is a major threat. My sole job is just to get out of this situation, which is why we want to name it.
Right.
That's why, because it protects us.
And like you said, I think some people find comfort in the idea of an addiction because... it creates a reason why, like they just can't,
and a clear path forward.
And a clear path forward.
Because of addiction, they can't help what they're doing.
Yes. It creates order inside of the chaos.
Yeah. And I think this is an important piece, because the other thing is, in that moment, a lot of focus now goes on to the partner, meaning the man,
yeah,
who's looked at porn. All efforts, you go to your bishop, and it's help him. Mm-hmm. You go to treatment and it's help him. And I find that a lot of women are like, wait, but where am I? Mm-hmm. Where am I in this story? And in crisis phase, it is so important. Most of the effort is going towards rebuilding that trust. Mm-hmm. Now, what's important is you can't have couples that stay in that forever, where it's like, You're now beholden to me to make me feel secure
for the rest of our lives.
Because you did this.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the question people have to ask in crisis phase. And I love, this is from Esther Perel's work, is, my first marriage is over. Do I want to have a second one?
With you.
Because that's the decision ultimately we have to make, that allowing time to heal wounds. Time may soften the immediacy of the crisis. Like the house, if a house is on fire, that's alarming. But if the initial blaze dies down and now you just have a small fire always burning in your house, you can just get really used to that. But the fire's never gone out. You have to get to a point where you're like, I want to put that fire out and I want to build something different with you. And that's going to take effort from you, and that's going to take effort from me, and that's going to take effort from we. It will take a collective effort. It's not just going to be the passage of time,
right?
Or you always owing me for the rest of my life. Oof. Right?
Yeah, and we can't go back to how it was.
You don't go back to what it was.
I love that Esther says that she says, I think the quote is something along the lines of, most people have two or three major marriages in their life, and it's up to them whether it's with somebody else or with the same person. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a point in everybody's marriage where you realize, oh, this circumstance, whether it's having a kid or becoming an empty nester or finding something out about your partner that you didn't know about them before, this changes everything. Mm-hmm. And we can't unchange it. You can't go back in time and change this thing about your life. And so you either need to reinvent yourself and adapt and find a way to move forward and heal and change and evolve, or the marriage is over. Well, the marriage is over regardless, but...
Marriage, and as Derek talks about, and this is true, we oftentimes have 3 to 5 marriages with our same partner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That different things happen. And if you're looking at long-term monogamous commitment, when we are little girls, we don't talk about that. It's just kind of a linear thing. You just follow it and you go from here, you get married, you have your first baby. But then think about when you have infidelity.
Maybe. A betrayal?
No. Oh my gosh. That's okay. Infertility. Sorry. That's a part of the story that's oftentimes not talked about.
Right.
You just get married. And you have a baby, and then you have two. And it's really going to be in your court how many you have.
Right.
Well, when you don't even get a choice if you're going to have one, that's a different conversation, mm-hmm. and your marriage has gone down a different path. So what I'm saying is, marriage is often disrupted early on and will be disrupted by the narrative we had when we were little. In the spirit of, like, what do I do?
Yeah, that's the next question.
That's like, what do I do? So we're in crisis phase. I've just discovered this. In the crisis phase, you're not necessarily going to do something. It's going to crack open. Remember in the very first episode of when we talked about betrayal trauma and we talked about that baby bird, you've now just discovered a crack. It can be the end of your relationship or the beginning of potential.
A crack in your eggshell.
Yeah.
Just for people who haven't listened to the episode before.
Yes, a crack in your eggshell that you have this idea and every egg holds potential. And so a crack can mean different things. So it really is, okay, it's recognizing that you're in fight, flight, or freeze. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to be, this also is going to be the time when it's going to call on the most mature parts of yourself and having to try to manage your emotions. Mm-hmm. Because it can be tempting at this point to move right into, I want to know every single detail. I want to know what, I want to know when, I want to know who, I want to know everything. Mm-hmm. And that is tempting to follow this investigative rabbit hole. And because the goal is if I get this information, it'll bring me some peace. That rarely happens. Mm-hmm. That question often opens up new questions. And it's like, well, what about this? And what about this? So really it's moving into, we're in crisis. This feels really disorienting. I need support. And it would be finding a person or two that can stand there with you, but not all of a sudden move to demonizing your husband, not telling you what to do. Because what's really important is I would say 95 to 97% of people either have been impacted by pornography or betrayal, or they know someone who has. So everyone has an antidote for you. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows exactly what you should do. And the other isolating piece can be, if you choose to stay or you stay in a certain way, now people are looking at you like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with you? Or they already know what's going on with your partner. And if he doesn't follow through with these steps, then you guys are just setting yourself up to failure and you're naive.
Yeah.
So finding those supports that can stand with you while you're in crisis phase, and it's an empathetic position. Mm-hmm. It is looking for empathy of the person who's looked at porn or betrayed some sort of the unspoken agreements that were had.
Yeah.
Is really trying to say all the empathetic things of, I can see, like, I am so sorry. My hope is if you decide you want to work through it, I think most people do in crisis phase, you're not making big decisions at that point, but I am sorry I have betrayed you. I am sorry I've broken our agreements. I am so sorry of the amount of disorientation you are feeling. Mm-hmm. That's it. And you might be sitting in that for
a
time limited thing. When you say people are in this for years, I think that's where people go awry. Is they really, one of the things that when people try to already make meaning early on in crisis phase of, you're the addict, I'm the betrayed, these now become your new identities. And what it does squash, when we talk about squashing that bug, is it squashes all curiosity. It squashes the conversations. It squashes the intimate, like, understanding of what this is and the opportunity to explore more deeply. It squashes it, and then you just move on.
So tell me about those conversations then. What are the curious conversations people should be having instead of just sticking with the label of, I'm betrayed, you're the betrayer, mm-hmm. and you fix your problems so that we can have a normal marriage again?
Yes.
And if you don't, I don't know what the plan is moving forward.
So
when you say get curious, what does that mean?
Well, let me go back a little bit, because I use the word intimate betrayal intentionally, similarly of feeling really out of control with your sexual relationship or sexual behavior.
Right.
The reason why I use intimate betrayal is instead
of what?
Instead of betrayal trauma.
Gotcha.
Because I too have had a lot of people reach out to me and they said, I really struggle with that title, because while I was deeply, deeply hurt, I wasn't traumatized. The amount of pain, like betrayal in and of itself, if you've ever been betrayed,
it hurts.
It hurts so deeply. Mm-hmm. But some people are like, I didn't feel traumatized, where other people do feel traumatized, but it leaves room for people to name their experience. If I already come at you as, you're an addict and I have been traumatized, it doesn't give, like, what is your experience with this? How does this feel to you? And so these are some of the questions, like, what was this like for you? Mm-hmm. I am so sorry. I can only imagine what it was like for you to discover what was on the computer. Now, these are high level conversations a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Like,
I feel like in this, what I hear you saying is in this stage at the beginning, instead of going straight to naming the problem and squashing curiosity, it's almost like naming your emotions, sitting with those and figuring out what you're feeling before you move on to anything else. Figure out what you're experiencing, how it feels in your body, versus trying to find meaning immediately.
And I want to be really clear that when we say sit with your emotions, that doesn't mean you're just calm in your reader's lounge feeling. Because have you ever tried to meditate and sometimes 5 minutes of meditation makes you want to jump out of your skin?
Yeah, or just punch a hole in the wall.
And that's why I think people turn to Google or they turn to Facebook groups, because it gives them an outlet. A lot of people think out loud. They need people to process. They need to go for a run. What that means is acknowledging you are in crisis. Part of crisis is grief. Mm-hmm. I have just experienced a loss that I can't even wrap my mind around right now. And so right now I need to tend to my emotions. And that might look like I say, reaching out to a dear friend. It might mean I'm going to go into a boxing class and just punch, punch, punch because I'm angry.
Or sit in the shower and sob.
Mm-hmm. It's sitting in a bathtub and being like, what has happened? It can be the going back and forth of, do I want to stay? Do I not? What do I want to do? It's messy. Mm-hmm. I really don't want to have the image of you're just sitting
just
there.
Sitting there calm.
Being like, let me feel this.
So getting curious about your own experience is part of it. And then I feel like there's a balance between getting curious about your partner's experience, mm-hmm, and also avoiding chasing the rabbit down the rabbit hole.
And that's so you're going to have two experiences, because the person that has been looking at porn, their job is to not get so defensive that they shut down their partner. And this is where the crisis phase is supposed to not be really long, because the meaning phase is where we start to actually get more curious. That's where more of the curiosity is of what does this mean for our relationship? This is really, I just lost my train of thought. It's moving out of the crisis phase and it's starting to say, okay, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for you? But you have two types of questions. And again, this, I really want to, Esther Perel is the one who's done the deep dive research on all of this. She talks about investigative versus detective questions. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes people, what they want is they ask a question, but they don't want to necessarily know the answer to the question. They want to make sure, they want to tend to a deeper feeling, common feelings of, do I belong? Do you still love me? Am I safe? Safety is a big one. Mm-hmm. Those are oftentimes what those questions are intended to satisfy. But instead, we get a detail, and it doesn't attend to the deeper core need of emotion, and it actually creates more insecurity. Mm-hmm. So investigative versus detective. Detective are going to be, well, what was she wearing? Did you like kissing her better than me? Did you like that body better than mine? Mm-hmm. Is that what you seriously want? It's asking for the nitty-gritty details. And oftentimes all it does is our imaginations can be really wild. They can be bigger. Oftentimes this is really common where women don't ask, well, what was it that you were looking or what did looking at this pornography mean to you? What did you get from it? Did it fulfill something in you? Because culturally we also just move. The culture also names pornography. It's just bad.
Right.
You just shouldn't do it. Repent and move on. And so it also moves people out of, there was something that drew me to pornography. There was something that drew me to look. And that's the piece that, while it's vulnerable, that's another place people need to go, to pause on judging it and moving again to behavior modification. The investigative questions are the meaning-making questions. I'm going to just read some that people can think about of. And in this word, what did looking at pornography mean to you? Okay. Why did it happen and when did it happen? A lot of times people will say, well, when I was 8, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. when I was 12. Do you feel guilty? Do you feel entitled to being able just to look at pornography? These are some of these investigative questions. Here's some others. Did you lie for the sake of deception? Like, were you genuinely trying to deceive me, or were you trying to protect what was going on? Because oftentimes people really don't want to deceive their partner. They didn't get into marriage being like, when I grew up to get married, my deepest hope is to betray my partner mm-hmm. and to try and get as many things past them as possible. What oftentimes happens is an early conversation that we haven't named in this podcast is this conversation. I have two deal breakers. If you look at pornography or if you cheat, I'm out. Partners hear that and they're like, I will never, ever tell my partner if I've looked at pornography.
Because mm-hmm. I don't want to lose them.
I don't want to lose them.
Yeah.
I love them. I love what we've built. And so there can be this dynamic. But this dynamic can also go back. I look at developmental stages, 12 years old, and now it's kind of 11. Worthiness interviews where masturbation and or pornography are part of it. And you learn how to manage this other piece of your life, which happens to coincide right at the time of sexual development when your hormones mm-hmm. turn on and you're really curious and you've got 9 million questions. And we learn how to manage that part of our life in a secret way. And so then it just gets perpetuated. Mm-hmm. And so I want to also look that there can be a sense of we're betrayed by our culture a little bit, of setting up this dynamic that we have to manage this part of ourself in a very secret way. And that we don't teach each other how to have, we don't teach young girls or young boys how to have these conversations. They're so important. We're not teaching them how to navigate and negotiate your sexual relationship and your desires and even to talk about sex.
Right.
You don't have to, because once again, we share the same values. We got married in the temple. What is there to talk about? Mm-hmm. So it's starting to unearth all the questions about sexuality, about intimacy, about relationship, even getting down into the micro of, can I go to lunch with the opposite sex where they feel more like a brother or sister, but it's the opposite sex?
Yeah.
Some person, like oftentimes we break our agreements after we've broken one. Like, meaning we go to lunch.
We don't know we've broken one until we've broken it.
Yeah. Like, we go to lunch with a dear friend and then we tell our partner and they're like, what? And you don't know it's an agreement, mm-hmm. but it was an expectation
right.
that was never named. So the goal of this is starting to ask those questions that might be vulnerable that you may not want to know, but actually ultimately bring security.
Yeah.
Those are the questions that bring security to the relationship, because now you're dealing with a relationship of truth and you're having to kind of mature yourself in a way that you didn't have to before, that your relationship was kind of built on the dream and it comes out of the dream a bit. Mm-hmm. And now you're dealing with each other as human beings with real lives, your own ambitions, your own goals, your own sexual desires. It's messier.
Yeah.
It's so important.
You're both looking at me like I have something to say.
Because you pondered off into the way.
Yeah. So we can cut this out if it doesn't make sense. Yeah. But the analogy that I'm thinking of while you're saying this that might provide some context, and some people might hate it. But to me, it makes a little bit of sense. It would be if a husband approached his wife and said, if I ever hear you talking negatively about your body image, it's a deal breaker for me. Because I can't have a wife who might have an eating disorder, or I can't have a wife who might pass on this negative self-image to my kids. Like, I don't want to contaminate my marriage with somebody who refuses to be kind to herself, and because I see you're beautiful. And if you're comparing yourself to these other people, like, I don't think I can tolerate being married to somebody in that situation. And then if a woman wakes up one morning and has a bad hair day or feels fat or feels gross, maybe she binge eats or has a donut and then feels guilty about it. And then she wants to hide it mm-hmm. because if her husband finds out that she's got this negative self-image or this, I don't know, this situation going on, heaven forbid, what would happen if he found out, you know?
She could lose him.
Yeah.
She could lose him.
And I don't think, and maybe that's a really bad example.
No,
but to me, it's
not a bad example.
Obviously, it doesn't have to do with like sex, and in our culture, there's like a huge conversation around chastity and the importance of it. But also, I'm just trying to think of something that, like, a lot of men don't really struggle with body image the same way women do. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a lot of women don't struggle with porn the same way men do, even though there are men who struggle with body image and women who struggle with porn. And giving the ultimatum and giving the hard line of this is a deal breaker can create a space where there is no curiosity and there's just a lot of hiding and a lot of secrecy and a lot of fear.
Shame.
And a lot of shame.
And that's, so what comes up for me when you say this is that porn can be one thing. Like, you can have various issues that we all bring to the table of our marriage. And I think what we're saying to each other's partners of, do you want to know me, or do you want to know me as you need me to be to keep you comfortable? Therefore,
profound.
I will not, I'm not, I don't want to know these parts of you because they make me so uncomfortable and so insecure. But then we're really surprised when we discover a secret. And so I think the most stable place we can get to in our marriage is, I want to know my partner. I want to know my husband. I want to know my wife.
Flaws and all.
All of it. So that then we can build on a place of collaboration, not coercion. When you are in a place of coercion, it's, you will do this, this, this. I am bestowing expectations on you. You go back to that letter. Mm-hmm. This is who you need to be. Because this is where I'm going to thrive and I'm going to be most comfortable.
Right.
You didn't actually have any participation in those expectations.
No.
You stepped into them.
Right.
So what we want to do is move back to a place of collaboration where we're creating with our partner.
And there's nothing that I could do stepping into those expectations other than disappoint at some point.
100%.
Like, there's no way.
But then it also requires you to be willing to disappoint your partner.
Which is really hard.
It's really hard. When we're dating everyone, we put on our best foot forward. Mm-hmm. We share like if you were to say, I will never marry someone that has a history with pornography. You hear that and you're like, yeah, that won't be a part of my marriage either. And boom, you just go into, and you're setting expectations, you're putting your best foot forward. And so one of the best things we can do in this meaning-making phase, it's, I'm going to just keep building, but you have the crisis. You start to ask these meaningful questions after you've both decided, yeah, we want to figure this out together. And it's a collaborative position. It's not a power play, because what we can do very easily and subtly is, now you're the gatekeeper over me. And everything I do is being managed and monitored by you. And I actually, it just keeps rebuilding actually a dynamic of secrecy. Mm-hmm. So what I see happen is people will then recreate, they'll come up with these agreements, and the agreements are broken again. Well, now we have new issues to address of breaking our agreements. Like, the issue is the exploitation of the agreements we're making together. Like, I'm not forcing you to, you said yes. So either you actually didn't agree to what we've just agreed on, or we have a bigger problem.
Yeah.
And then you get to actually deal with the real problems. Pornography often is just the symptom that something else is going on. It also doesn't have to be a problem. Mm-hmm. It can also be, this is how it makes me feel. This can be a part of my life that represents a part of my sexuality I never got to explore or discover and become curious about, and it represents that for me. Our marriage actually isn't broken. There's nothing wrong with you. I'm not doing this because I'm deeply flawed. I'm doing this because I am curious. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen a husband explain to his wife why he looks at porn and had her mind just go, oh?
Almost 95% of the time.
Can you share like some examples of what that might look like?
So most of the time, people... Is that going to get onto your thing?
No, we can hear it, but it's just a puppy.
Okay. What oftentimes happens is, because what the question that oftentimes isn't asked is, well, what do you look at? People already assume this is what you're looking at, and that porn is porn is porn.
Yeah.
And so oftentimes women think it's...
That's like saying food is food is food.
Uh-huh. It's really like... kinky and swinging from the rafters, and it's hardcore visual video imagery. Oftentimes, the clients that I see, it is way dialed back, and they're like, it's photographs, and it's of women that look at me in a way that's like, they want me, and it makes me feel competent, and it makes me feel good, and that's what it is, and they're like, oh. And it can create a place of empathy because it's so far from what... I feel like I need to ask you guys a question.
Can we get personal, or do you not want to get personal?
I'll follow your lead, honey.
You've already talked about Nate's penis.
On a previous episode.
I was just going to say, we had the same conversation, and when we talked about it, I started laughing.
That's true.
Because that's really like, what happens often.
We had a pornography conversation, and she was like, well, what do you look at? And I told her what I searched for, and she was like, wait, that's it? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, oh.
Honestly, it was like this huge weight was lifted off my shoulders, and I just started giggling because I was like, this is not as bad as I thought it was.
Right. And it did something to you. But what you just talked, you asked the question that you you wondered about.
Yeah.
And when we ask these questions, then we further empathy, and you're dealing with truth. While truth can be painful, it is a much better platform to deal with a person and grow with them than, again, on that perception. And so you modeled that perfectly. Mm-hmm. And so I say these things that hopefully these... As a therapist, I find that I don't want to minimize a person's experience or make it sound really easy. Like, you just need to sit down and feel, and then you need to have these conversations. This can be really messy. What I do encourage is for people to seek out support that will allow them to go through these phases, to call on the best parts of themselves, to support them in making the meaning instead of demonizing a partner. One of the biggest... challenges is people can start to say, no more screens, no more cell phones, no, like, you are bound to nothing.
Right. Because I feel like there's a gray line between being transparent and being honest and then being like an investigator into your partner's life and being paranoid.
Yeah.
Like wanting transparency and then...
wanting to control
it doesn't bring
and then not allowing your partner privacy are two very different things. Mm-hmm. Like if your partner can't even have their own privacy anymore, like if you have access to all their social media accounts and their email and their phone and you're constantly checking them, like there's a line between wanting transparency and then not allowing your partner privacy.
And that's in that meaning making question of like, what is our balance between privacy and transparency? Because that's oftentimes when we get married, it's now suddenly I am entitled to 100% all parts of you.
Right.
And so, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just being entitled to 100% all parts of you, like it's a little bit of a controlling thing to want control of your partner. It doesn't allow for autonomy. It doesn't allow for a space for, like, I can't own my wife's desires. Mm-mm. I can't own the things that she thinks in her head or the things that she fantasizes about or the things that she wants and needs. Like, she can let me in and clue me in. And part of my not being able to own that stuff, part of her being independent from me creates a little bit of like
desire
and mystery. And like, there's choice there. Like, we're not forced to be together. She's choosing it. And there's things going on in her mind that could offer her the opportunity to choose something else, which gives me an incentive to try and to continue to put effort into our relationship. And like, I understand how getting hurt, the reaction would be to want to control your circumstances so you don't get hurt again. Mm-hmm. But there comes a point where I feel like you have to progress beyond that, where you might need control right out of the gate to like help to reestablish some trust and gain some ground and some order inside the chaos. But there comes a point if you want to have a true intimate, like connected relationship where you have to let the other person be a separate person.
And that's where people move. So you have a couple of things, because in the betrayed moment, you can move to now becoming fully enmeshed. instead, or detached and disconnected. Yeah. You can move to the other end of I want nothing to do with you ever, and we'll coexist. The greatest place that we experience the greatest amount of intimacy, the greatest amount of sexual connection, is when we have you have me, and then we have we, but you can distinctly identify those three pieces. When you move to enmeshed, again, and I've talked about this before.
When you mean we are the same thing?
Yeah. Like Hollywood loves to celebrate that this is what true love looks like when you don't have your own name anymore. Like it's not Brad and it's not Angelina, it's Brangelina. Mm-hmm. That does not breed the kind of love, intimacy, trust. It's you settle in, like we really want to be desired, but if there's no room for our partner to desire us, we will not have that. But it does require and call on the deepest, most mature, developed parts of ourselves. Mm. And that's, I recently just shared that marriage is a growth-promoting machine, not a love train you hop aboard and ride. It requires that we work, that we put effort, that we learn how to self-soothe, that we manage our emotions. It requires all of that.
Yeah.
And so one of the things is I go back to the squishing. We can't, any partner can choose what they want to do with this. They can have an entire, they have layers of support culturally just to move into addict, betrayal, trauma. They can. And that is a path that is appropriate for some people. I don't want to minimize that. And I don't want to say there's a right way. And there's other ways we can look at this. Right. And other ways we can move through this. And so I think that's what this podcast is for.
And that there are things inside the system of being the betrayed, the betrayal and the addict narrative that can be unhelpful. Mm-hmm. There are things in there that could probably be helpful for a lot of people, mm-hmm. but there's also things in there that where you can get trapped mm-hmm. in a cycle of I'm always the betrayed, he's always the addict, mm-hmm. and you can get stuck into never advancing past that narrative and regaining trust in a real relationship. I mean, one of my favorite things that I've heard you say is that a lot of times the addict narrative, part of what it's trying to do is just eliminate the sickness or eliminate a specific behavior. Like he's looking at porn. If we can get him to stop looking at porn, our relationship will be better.
Yes.
But when you think of your physical health, you don't think, oh, if I can just stop being sick, then I'm healthy. There's more to health than just not being sick. And there's more to sexual health than just not looking at porn. And we don't talk about what sexual health looks like. When we think about physical health, we talk about eating healthy foods, exercising on a regular basis, being socially active, connecting with other people. There's things that we can do to make our bodies healthy beyond just avoiding sickness. But we don't talk about that in the sexual context very
often. That's actually the next phase. So you have the crisis phase, the meaning-making phase, and then the vision phase. And before we get to that vision phase, the other piece of this, like, addict and betrayed piece is it always is one person's problem. Like, our marriage was actually just fine. And then you had to come in and look at porn. Like we were just fine. And so it can also continue to make the person who's stepped out of the agreements that were probably created on faulty terms to begin with the problem. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that need to go to therapy. They're the ones that need to go through the treatment program. And I need to heal from my trauma. And you hurt me.
You stole my story.
And that is a true thing, right? Uh-huh. Like we've named that is a very real thing. However, if you continue to deflect instead of look at this as an opportunity of this exposed aspects of our relationship that were currently glossed over or buried or hidden, now we have the opportunity. They've been unearthed. Now what would we like to do?
Yeah.
And that can be actually the most powerful, solidifying, deepening, motivating, purpose-finding work we can do as a marriage. And what I see, much like a broken bone, and I love this because when bones are broken and they repair, they are stronger than how they were in their original state. Mm-hmm. Because the body tends to it and puts all sorts of minerals and calcium and all these things to make that bone stronger than it ever was.
And the cool thing to me is that the break is always there. Mm-hmm. It just has all these things to fortify it. So because of the break, it's stronger.
Yes.
Because the break is always there.
And I like that because, again, as we go to Mormon culture, how many times do we go through a trial and then we are never grateful for the trial when we're in a trial. Mm-hmm. But once you get through it, you're like, I am so grateful for that. I cannot tell you how many marriages that have moved beyond that, whether they stayed together, some people choose to end. That is a narrative that I want to put in this podcast, that mm-hmm. some people choose to end and then they find that they're better co-parents than they ever were, or they are happier. I have a lot of women who just need permission to be like, I am done. You can be totally done. Mm-hmm. And though, for the sake of moving forward, I have so many people that say that was the best thing that ever happened, because for a lot of my marriage, I just kind of was holding my breath, hoping this would never happen. And then I thought it was the most, the worst thing that could ever have happened to my marriage. And so then when the worst thing happened, it's like, oh, okay, now we got that out of the way. Mm-hmm. That was so painful. I didn't know what to do. I was disoriented. But I feel like now I'm actually collaborating with you. I actually feel like I'm on your team. I actually feel like you have my back and I have yours. And what I really wanted, I'm sorry that the price, this was the price that had to be paid, but I feel deeper and more connected and more secure with you than I ever did before. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that holding, a lot of people enter marriage holding their breath of, I hope I'm not the one that ends up like that. And the reality is most people will have a relationship with sexual imagery. That is the reality. So having that idea that it's just the unlucky, it happens to almost everybody. So then what? And hopefully by doing this work, the younger generations can have, it's happening.
Yeah.
It's happening.
So my last question before we end this, and Ange might have some questions also, but is there a way to skip the betrayal phase and have these important conversations before the betrayal happens?
Or? Ideally. Absolutely.
So so for listeners who aren't in the midst of betrayal right now, and mm-hmm. they're not feeling like, oh my gosh, you know, my husband
yeah.
went behind my back and did this. What are the conversations they could have with their partner to set themselves up to be successful down the road were this something like this to come up?
What is your relationship with sexual imagery or pornography? What do you want your relationship to be with it? What do we want?
What do you mean? But like, what are the options when you
say
that?
Some people are like, I would like to look at pornography once a month, and this is what I'd like to be looking at, and vulnerable conversations, right? Like how many people have ever talked about pornography in this way? Cause it's
I can feel the pitchforks already.
100%. Like there's no room, and that's okay. Some people will say, I actually don't want visual imagery in our marriage, but what about masturbation? Can that be a part of our marriage?
I feel more pitchforks coming out.
I know. And really,
but these are the conversations.
These are the conversations. And again, this
and you might be both on the same page, and you might both be like, "Nope, I don't want that. Nope, I don't want that." And that's fine.
But now you're both choosing it,
right? Instead of having it be an unspoken agreement.
And it moves you out of holding your breath too. This is what we've both chosen. Like you can ask the questions, and just because you talk about it doesn't mean you have to do it.
Right.
But by not asking it, you set yourself up to then have these separate lives, because there's not room to bring yourself to the table.
Yeah.
So questions about this, what would a really great sex life look like? What about frequency? What about quality? Who initiates? How do you want me to receive when you do initiate? Is there a time of day? When do you feel most intimately connected to me? What are parts of our emotional relationship that allow you to then open up into our sexual relationship? Are there times when you just want to have sex and it's not intimately connected? Is that kind of sex okay? Or is it mostly going to need to be deep and intimate, right? Like it's starting to develop, A, learning how to talk about sex, B, putting in some sexual flexibility. People get really nervous about talking about sex or fantasy or desire because they feel like, and I will underscore this, that if it's said, that means I have to do it. Hmm. Instead of just being like, that's a great question. Some people have a fantasy and it's best to never actually act out that fantasy. Mm-hmm. But you can know what's going on in people's heads and you could play with that fantasy. There's a lot of things we can do that can expand our boundaries without having to compromise our deepest values and our relationship agreements or desires. But it's learning that art that we rarely are satisfied with just healing the trauma or managing the behavior. Just getting out of crisis phase isn't oftentimes where the story ends. That's where it begins. Once we're out of crisis phase, that's when we can do the deepening. But too often people stop at crisis phase and then they're just managing for the rest of their life what you talked about. And it doesn't create the intimacy that they ultimately wanted.
Yeah. They feel like a full-time babysitter.
Full-time. And they're just waiting for the next time it's going to happen. So
I've even heard people say they're like just waiting for their partner to die so that they can...
Mm-hmm. So
that they can maybe be blessed with somebody else that they actually love and have. It's like, I made this covenant. I'm going to stick with it. And my hope is that my partner dies so that I can find somebody who's better for me.
Right.
It's like, instead of enduring a life hoping for your partner to die, maybe ask hard questions.
Well, and I can't.
And see if you can't get past the...
It's a skill, like learning how to have sexual health conversations, learning how to talk about your sexual relationship. It takes effort. There are fantastic books that can help you. Working with a trained sex therapist can help you. Going to a class on sexuality can help you. Mm-hmm. But just too often people get stuck at the crisis phase, and they're stuck there and they're wondering why their relationship isn't better because they don't feel traumatized anymore and he's not looking at porn anymore. But they're like, is there more to than this? And that's the hope of why we're doing this podcast, is to kind of name these things and to help people realize there can be more.
Totes.
Well, I just want to speak to my story as a little girl, imagining my marriage to be one way and now having a marriage that is completely and 100% different from that story that I told myself. And it is, like, exponentially greater and more joyful than anything that I could have imagined up or put in a box or fit into a cultural mold. And that's what I hope we can show people, is that your life doesn't have to look a certain way to be wonderful, and it can change. You can have something greater than you ever imagined.
Yeah.
I love you.
Love you too.
I think that's a great note to end on.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, we hope you enjoyed it.
We want to have Kristen back more often because she's a dear friend of ours. And if you enjoyed this episode, if you got something from it, if you think a friend would enjoy it, I'd love it if you just like take a screenshot on your phone and post it on social media and tag us at Mormon Marriages on Instagram or on Facebook. And even better, what could they do if they enjoyed this? Leave a rating and a review on iTunes.
I'm trying to read your mind. Yes, leave a rating and review.
We go and read all of them, good and bad.
We
and
do.
The bad ones we use to try and make the podcast better, and the good ones we read at night before we go to bed to convince ourselves that we're doing something really good in the world.
Yes, we do. We are taking all of your constructive criticism, whether it's delivered nicely or not so nicely, to make us better. So thank you. And we hope you join us next week. We get a little bit personal next week, but then again, when do we not get personal? So it's a good episode. It's a short episode. So join us next week, and we'll see you later.
Bye.